Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
I'm Dr. Redmond.
I'd like to thank you for joining us here as we get deeper into Season 12, and I get to complain about something just really bothers me right off the bat. So, even before we get to the synopsis, I just want to mention this because it bothered me so much, and I made a log of it, and I'll do a supercut of how much it bothers me. One of these days. Actually, it's definitely, the supercut's definitely going to be out by the time this episode goes up. So go check out the supercut on the Hidden Object Guru YouTube channel, where you can see me complaining about this, which is, so Aaron Hotchner had a catchphrase, and everybody loved his catchphrase. And his catchphrase was, wheels up in 30. And he said that whenever they had to fly somewhere. They would have all the thing together, and then he's like, okay, we're done with the little, you know, conversation here at the table. Wheels up in 30. And then they would all know to go and get their go bags and meet downstairs and drive down to the airfield. And so the one week David Rossi was running things, he rather embarrassingly, they're like, well, he shouldn't just say wheels up in 30. That was Hotch's thing. So what's David Rossi going to say? And then he humiliated himself and all of us by saying, this is true. Looking at everyone at the around the table after they finished the profile, not the profile, the case intake, and said, we good? We fly. I'm like, oh, God, why did you agree to say that out loud, David Rossi? Like, what are you doing, David Rossi? You've humiliated yourself and made us all sad. We good, we fly.
We good,
we fly. Oh, all right. Yes, but when, David? So, and here's what it comes down to. And then next, right, we get Emily taken over. And Emily's got to have her own catchphrase. Now, logically, she could just start saying wheels up in 30.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, any sane person would. It means something. It's not just something Hotch said. But they're like, no, we have to show that it's good that she's running now, and she's better at the job than Hotch was. So we're going to have her say, wheels up in 20.
What? They moved the airfield closer to...
And this is what's so unbelievably dumb about the show, because, and I guess a lot of people don't understand this, but like, wheels up in 30 is not a random thing he says. It's actually very thoughtful, because, and this is true, the airfield is a 15-minute drive from their office. You can go on Google Maps and look at it. It is 15 minutes to get. It takes about 15 minutes to drive from where they work to the airfield. So wheels up in 20 means you have 10 minutes to grab your go bag and meet us downstairs at the SUVs, and then we're going to start driving over the airfield. It will take us 15 minutes to get to the airfield, 5 minutes to get settled on the plane, and then we will be in the air in a total of 30 minutes.
Yes. Now they have 5 minutes to...
Well, now they have, no, now they have five minutes to get their go bag. They have 10 minutes. So they have to speed through red lights and stop signs.
Whoa, and five minutes
to get in the air. I mean, later it's going to get even dumber because she's going to say, wheels up now. And I'm like, so you're sending the plane without you? Like, what did you...
And besides, it wasn't a catchphrase.
Well, no, but it turned into a catchphrase.
Yeah, I know.
And that's the difference, is that, like, it's a practical thing he said that really means that really means something. And then they decided it was just a catchphrase. So they're like, oh, well, we'll give Emily a better catchphrase. And they're like, but you've stripped meaning out of it.
Well, no. You wanted to flaunt the fact that the FBI could speed through red lights.
Yep. But it's that was
Emily's contribution to the BAU. Yeah,
speeding
is her contribution.
Well,
they saved 10 minutes.
But the crazy part is, right, like, A, I want to remind everybody, there's no way you could get there faster. Like, you just can't, because it's on a military base. You know? You just, you can't bully your way through a military base. There are people around, and important things are happening. So, no, like, there's no way in which her catchphrase, by comparison, makes any sense at all. But, let's move on to the actual episode we're here to talk about. Go.
The first one is Mirror Image.
Ooh.
And when a complete stranger contacts Lewis and identifies himself as her estranged younger brother, the BAU attempts to uncover the imposter's true identity, only to find themselves forced to play a high-stakes cat-and-mouse game orchestrated by serial killer Peter Lewis.
Aww. Okay. And again... Yet another episode goes by without anyone mentioning how weird it is that he has the same last name as Tara. Oh, sorry, Tara.
Tara.
They actually point out the Tara thing this time.
Yes.
Which, by the way, I would question, right? And there's a funny part where she's like a racist in school when she was young, like has not a familiarity with Gone with the Wind. Other than to know it annoyed her. But I'm like, but, you know, how would he have even stumbled onto that as a way of annoying her if he wasn't familiar with Gone with the Wind? Like, do you know how familiar with Gone with the Wind you have to be to know the name of the house they lived in?
The plantation, yes.
Pretty familiar, actually.
Yes, it's not like...
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they
so
might
it honestly,
be familiar
it sounds
with her
like,
name.
I mean, it honestly sounds like not that he didn't know, but it sounds like he accidentally called her Tara the first time and she recoiled and said, "You can't call me that. That's like how they say it in the Gone with the Wind." And she essentially gave him a way to annoy her. I would imagine.
Yes, and I would say
I feel like that's the only way that story could have happened.
And the only other thing that I would say to that is, why the hell did her parents give her the name Tara in the first place?
They had to know the unfortunate associations. Oh, my God. But anyway.
Well, maybe they watched Gone with the Wind and loved it.
That's true. It's possible.
But why would you?
Hattie McDaniel
or maybe they didn't
win that
even
Oscar.
Know.
I mean, you know.
Maybe they didn't know about the film and
maybe.
Liked the name. But
it's not popular enough. I mean, given her age, it's not a popular enough name at the time that like people would know of just the name without the connotation, especially if you're a Black American.
Well, yeah, I know.
No, I mean, it's just weird.
Her age, yeah.
It's
I mean,
given
it's,
her
it's
yeah.
I mean, the '70s and the '80s. For God's sake, Gone with the Wind was.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there are a million problems with Gone with the Wind.
Oh yeah.
You know, everything from sort of the slave issue
to the unbelievable rapiness of Rhett Butler. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
The rapist
like
Rhett Butler.
There's one. There's not just one thing wrong with that. But yes, this is the episode that fundamentally it gives you that last bit of hope that maybe they're going to do something interesting with Tara Lewis. And then. They fully commit to never doing anything interesting with Tara Lewis.
She's just there.
She's just there. She's just taking up space. She's just there on the show, and that's it. And, you know, I mean, I never stopped hoping they would do something. And you watch this, and you're like, so you finally get the story of that she teased the Hannibal character with, and it's the most anticlimactic story you could possibly imagine. Her brother got beaten up by some racists.
Yeah.
And then she got into a fist fight with the racist. That's it? That's the takes one to no one story you beguiled Hannibal Lecter with? The time you got into a fist fight with a Nazi? Like, if she had secretly, like, stabbed that guy, or, like, broken his, or, like, sabotaged his bike and he got in like did something really shady and then he got into a horrible bike accident, I'd be like, okay, I understand why this was such a serious story for her and why she thought it was worth confronting. But it's like literally a Nazi picked on her brother and she punched him. That's it. That's the story? That's just what you should do. That's not scandalous, and it's not going to impress a serial killer. So yeah, I was very disappointed with that. But I will say, kind of an interesting episode.
No, it was an interesting episode.
Yeah.
For sure. I thought, you know, it handled all of that. It was a concise episode. It's very focused on the story it's telling this week.
You're totally right.
Yeah.
That's a good way to describe it.
Yeah.
Yeah, like it's clearly there's this guy who's turned up. He thinks he's her brother. And let's follow that to its logical conclusion. Yeah, there weren't any flights of fancy. There wasn't a lot of extra rambling. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, no, this was, of all of the episodes, this is a very nice, competent episode without there was nothing that really took you away from the story.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of some of the other stories, and usually they're the ones that Matthew Gray Gubler
makes. Yeah.
Sometimes that where there's just one sort of story from beginning to end.
Yeah,
that is not got all this extraneous stuff that doesn't take you down all these weird paths. You know, so
yeah. And by the way, there's some junk science in here because Peter Lewis brainwashes people. That's what he does. Yeah. Right. That's his theme. That's what he does. And he brainwashes. And the brilliant thing Peter Lewis does is he takes people who were abused as children who already have fractured personalities. And he, you know, uses his drugs and talking to them to make them do things. This guy, he went even farther. He took him for weeks and transformed him into Tara's brother. Right? Yeah. And it's interesting because he had to have both of them for weeks to have pulled this off, which we know he did. It's an elaborate plan. But then you get this bizarre aside from Luke at one point saying, you know, brainwashing doesn't work. To which I would respond, yes, it does. Who told you brainwashing doesn't work? Are you crazy? He's like, MK Ultra tried for 40 years to figure out how to drug people. Yeah, they tried to figure out how to like shoot someone with a dart and make them do what you want, and no, that doesn't work. But yeah. Brainwashing works. Have you ever heard of suicide bombers? Like, this actual team went to a situation where, like, a teenage girl blew herself and her family up because Luke Perry told her to. That's brainwashing. You isolate people. You starve them. You tell them you're the only person who can give them anything. You know, your approval is the only love they will ever have. Guess what? They'll do whatever you frigging want. Brainwashing works, okay? And it's insane. No, you can't fire a dart at someone and have them do whatever you want, but that's, you know, a crazy thing to want. Brainwashing. Oh, yes.
Well, I don't know.
Works.
Maybe whoever wrote that line had watched Naked Gun stories from Police Files.
Squad. Where, the idea that you could hypnotize someone and give them a word to say, and then they would become a brainwashed assassin.
Well,
where,
in fact,
like, Reggie, where they have Reggie Jackson gonna shoot, God, who is it? The mayor? The governor? Who? The president?
The
I don't remember who. Oh, the queen! Yes, the Queen of England! That's who it was! It's a wonderful movie.
No, it's a wonderful movie. I just started to watch it last night. It was just like, that's why it came up. I mean,
I'm like, what? Yeah, weird
remember.
Reference.
There's
for you
Ricardo.
To make.
Yeah, there's
Ricardo Montalban. Yeah.
You know, just clicking something in, right? Okay, all you need is this. Click.
Click the thing, and then boom. Yeah, and he'll do it. And the ring and the hot dog. But,
never mind.
But anyway, no, that's a wonderful movie where if you haven't seen The Naked Gun from the Files of Police Squad, you really got to see Naked Gun. It's fantastic.
It's just...
We recommend Sledgehammer all the time, but Naked Gun, oh boy, you got to see Naked Gun, because there wouldn't have been a Sledgehammer without Naked Gun.
But Naked Gun is just, I mean, it is just completely absurd, but I still found myself laughing.
It's brilliant. It's absurd, and it's so good. Anyway, we're not here to talk about Naked Gun, obviously. That's about as far afield from what we're here to talk about as you can conceivably get.
The brainwashing thing.
Except for the brainwashing thing. But no, like, and then how they catch him is, like, literally, once again, they're just like, they check the financial thing, the financial records, find out he bought something from people who make bondage equipment.
Yeah.
And the bondage people had his real address. So it's just weird that, like, eight episodes apart, they actually find him the exact same way he gave, because A, he wanted them to find him, and B, he gave his real address to people who make bondage equipment. It's just, it's weird that he's found in exactly the same incredibly specific way.
Well, you know, there's a consistency to Peter Lewis.
Oh, yeah.
It worked the first time. Why wouldn't it work the second?
And you're right. It works. And the thing is, everything he has planned works completely. The only part that doesn't work is nobody gets killed by his nail gun trap. But, like, that was a plan that was easily defeatable by looking up.
Yeah. Oh,
literally, all they had to do was... look up, and they would have realized there was a nail gun trap. There's a box of nails over our head.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're like, oh my god. He's like, there's a secondary trap. And it's... And honestly, it is kind of a good scene where they're trying to disarm it. And he's like, wait a minute. These aren't fuses. They're shotgun shells. That must mean... And that is a good clue that, no, the shotgun pointing his head isn't loaded because all the shells are down in the fuse box. That was a nice scene. I actually really liked that bit.
I don't know. That all it was actually consistent from basically consistent from beginning to end.
Oh yeah. Like it's a solid episode.
And you can believe it because Peter Lewis would have done that double thing. You
the
can believe
extra
it
trick because he loves toying with people. That's his entire thing.
Yeah.
The only but honestly, the only thing that really disappoints me about this episode is the It throws away, like, the last gasp of Tara Lewis could be an interesting character. And they're going to do something with Tara Lewis being, being a sociopath, right? Like, that all gets put to bed here. Like, this is the episode where it becomes clear that, no, whatever we had thought of with the character, whatever we had maybe planned with the character, that's all gone. She's just going to be a member of the team. And fun fact... this is the last time she's going to be the focus of an episode.
Yeah. Yeah. She just literally, from now on, fades into the background. Because don't you remember when we did our episodes on season 15?
We're like,
I can't even tell you what she was in.
Yeah. Let's like, how many episodes did she not friggin' have a line almost?
Yeah.
Like, you know, so many of them. It's so disappointing. Because, you know, we love Aisha Tyler.
Yes.
We love Aisha Tyler.
Well, we just have to go back and watch Archer.
Yeah, we'll just watch Archer again. And, you know, there she actually gets stuff to do every week. And she's deeply entertaining. Apparently, the new season will have already aired by the time they get here. It's this weird situation. I was watching an interview with John Benjamin, but hopefully by the time people hear this, they've already seen the new season. But yeah, we're currently going through the coronavirus. This is recording. We are in the April part of quarantine. A little behind the scenes stuff for you. And I was listening to an interview with John Benjamin because I've been like, I saw him and I'm like, I'm curious about when Archer's coming back. And he's like, yeah, the episodes are done. They just haven't recorded our voices yet. And they're currently trying to figure out how to, like, because we can't go to recording studios. So how do we record all of this?
Yeah.
Yeah, and Archer was never recorded with all the people in the same studio. Like, nobody lives anywhere near each other. They just all go to separate studios, and brilliant audio editing turns that show into the masterpiece of dialogue that it is. But now it's even harder because they can't go to any of the professional recording studios. So yeah, it's being delayed by the pandemic. Even though, if anything wouldn't be, you'd think it'd be animation, but now even it is. Yeah, it's just so sad because it's like, they do good, like... even as they're abandoning the interesting parts about her character, there's still the little clues in there that it could have been, because you get all of these lines from her fake brother about how she could never relate and she could never, like, understand how he was treated and blah, 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 blah. But this show then posits that not as something seriously wrong with her, but as just normal, neglectful older sibling who went off to college and left her brother with, you know, a violent drunk.
Yeah.
You know, and it's tragic. It's
and sad. She never went home, and she never...
I know.
I mean, that unbelievable. I mean, actually, the very fact that she ignores her entire family and everything else afterwards...
Yeah. It should factor into our feelings about her as a character.
Well, our theory about...
Yeah, our theories about her.
Basically, that there is something seriously wrong with Tara Lewis.
Yeah.
And yet the show just... No.
Shies away from that.
And everybody gets, you know, really... You know, she says, no, I was the prodigal.
You weren't.
Though. I walked away and never looked back.
But that's not what the story of the prodigal son is. The story of the prodigal son is the guy who gets cast out and gets welcomed back. Yep. And yeah, you left and you never looked back, but you weren't cast out. Your brother was cast out of the family. He was the prodigal son. Like, it's a nice message, but what do you call it?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm going, why are they bringing this up? Because it doesn't fit.
No, it doesn't fit. But they wanted her to feel, they wanted to have her, well, a biblical reference resonates with people, and they want to have her say something to snap him out of it, you know? So, like, I get why that line is in there, even as that line doesn't really make sense based on the situation. No, he is the prodigal son, because he is the one who was cast out and then, you know, turned his back on his family when he felt they betrayed him, and then, you know, is welcomed back now. That he has had something bad happen to him.
Yes, except that she has had nothing to do
with
her family, clearly.
I know, right?
And this is it. A profiler? Is she a psychologist?
She's can never remember. Like you, I mean, she has to. Well, no, of course she's a psychologist, because remember, she's the one they went to make all of the questionnaire for the pedophile village.
Yeah, and so she never... She never thinks that there's anything wrong.
Never going to see her. This is a woman who, you know, whose fiance left her because she wouldn't stop hanging out. Like, she refused to have anything in her life but hanging out with serial killers. No, she does not see any problem with never being in touch with her family.
No, and never ever thinking about, well, why is her brother this way when he seemed to be okay? Yeah. It has to be more than just her mother's death. Oh, and absolutely. Obviously her mother's death didn't bother her even.
No. Again, there's all weird. Of this evidence here for our meta Tara Lewis, and the show would just never pull the trigger on it. It's fascinating. It's like all of the pieces are there. But the show's just like, no, she's just going to be a regular psychologist the way the rest of them are. She's going to, and it's like,
without a opportunity. Without a personal life.
Yeah, the only difference is the rest of them have personal lives and she doesn't. But even that's not that big of a change, given the type of people these are. It's very frustrating, you know?
Well, like yeah, but that just means it wouldn't have been the show that all these people seem to love.
That's true. People love how frustrating it is, I guess.
Well, because from what I was reading just before we started the show, and I was reading a few things to you, I'm looking at these and going, okay, may be right that people actually don't understand a lot of this area. I mean, how people can think they are learning so much from this show is beyond me. But if you've listened to our podcasts up to this point, you will have figured that one out by now.
Oh, yeah. Hopefully you will have noticed that, no, they get facts wrong all the time. They get figures wrong all the time. They don't understand fundamentally how people work.
And then there's an inconsistency throughout that. Anyway, I mean, there's a whole bunch of things I really... by the time we finish this, we're going to have that serious discussion about, I mean, what does it say that this show has all of these fans that really stuck with it for a long time.
Hell or high water.
Yeah, and in fact, yeah, I mean, and they were still sticking with it when, you know, when right to the end. I mean, it wasn't like it had tanked in the ratings. It never got as bad as Beyond Borders in the ratings.
Nope.
Never. I mean, it did sort of start to fall out of the top 20.
But still, but, it was a well-liked, well-watched show. But, you know, as I say, as to quote The Simpsons, the adventures they had between now, who knows what adventures they'll have between now and the point at which they become unprofitable. And that's honestly what happened to the show. And I mean, this is what I explain to people. It's like everyone who works on a show gets a raise every year. That's just how contracts work. And by year 15, it's just too expensive to keep doing the show. The only way to keep doing the show is to fire half the cast.
And they were starting to lose in the key demographic.
Well, exactly. That and was the thing is, that there is a...
down.
Oh, no, but I mean, what it comes down to is there is a point at which, like, you pay people more every year and you're still turning a profit. But if the show doesn't grow every year and shows can't grow indefinitely, at some point it's not going to be profitable anymore. And then you pull the plug on the show.
And which it's is as simple why as that. Star Trek did the smart thing. 7 years.
Oh, yeah, 7 years. And that's a fun fact. And this is from Judy. Fun fact, everybody. Here's your... here's your semi-regular window into biblical law. According to the laws of Judaism, you can only, and there is no such thing as a contract that lasts longer than 7 years. Mm-hmm. And after every 7 years, all contracts have to end. You couldn't even be a slave, for more than 7 years.
Yeah, that's exactly
that's how long any contract lasts. And that is why, and that part of the Old Testament, part of the Talmud, that's why today, employment contracts in the entertainment industry can only last 7 years.
Most of them were, you know, in the beginning.
Yeah.
It's
no, but
really...
I mean, that's the actual reason. That's why the letter said 7 years, because that was the biblical law on the subject.
Yeah, and it's just a fascinating
By the way, I this is a true fact. I got into a fight with someone on Twitter one time because I used the term biblical law. And he's like, I'm a Christian and I've never heard of the term biblical law. And I'm like, you know, there's an Old Testament too, right?
And do you know that it's full of laws?
It's just made of laws.
That's all it is. Well, I mean,
well, no,
all
it's a history
it is.
Book
it's
got and a story. It's a law
book. And no,
it's okay. It is. No. Okay. The Old Testament is a creation myth, a bunch of stories that may or may not be based in stuff that happened in the Bronze Age, and then, you know, a bunch of laws for how to live. Like, that's the entirety of, that's what the Old Testament is. And if you take out the laws, there's not a lot there.
Well, yes. Just... Plus, it has a whole bunch of morals. Right?
Yes,
like
true.
All of those proverbs.
Aesop's fable type deal.
Yeah, and then it's got a whole bunch of songs that you can take most of the psalms and turn them into songs, and then you've got all of these weird prophets. In other words, what I think about whenever I think about that, what the image that came to my mind was that Blues Brothers when they're driving through the mall near the beginning. Right. And he says, wow, this mall has everything. And
I'm true.
Yeah, the Old Testament.
It's
got
just like that.
Everything.
It's packed in there. Like, yeah, everything you could possibly want. But so it's like I got yelled at by someone on Twitter because they weren't like they considered themselves a Christian and had just no idea what was in the Old Testament.
Like, well, no, then yes, but then
they're
they
American
probably,
evangelicals, I know.
They probably don't have any idea what's in the New Testament either.
Well, no,
because
I mean,
their preachers tell them what it says and they believe it. So
one of my favorite parts of one of my favorite reactions was that they made that terrible movie Bruce Almighty and they made a sequel because Steve Carell got famous. And this will be our last digression, I promise. They made a sequel because, well, okay, maybe not last. But anyway, because Steve Carell got famous, they made a sequel to it because he had been a minor co-star in that movie. And it was the first one was about what if a guy became God, blah, 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 blah. And the second one was what if Noah's Ark happened, but in the present day, right? And they're like, why didn't it do well? You know, why didn't it do well? We thought, you know, there was this huge market out there for people who are Bible people in this whole Christian movie industry. And I'm like, here's how out of touch Hollywood is. They honestly don't understand that evangelicals don't like the Jewish parts of the Bible. And that's all it comes down to. They are not interested in the Jewish parts of the Bible. Don't make a movie about Samson. Don't make a movie. They wouldn't.
That
even
was the funny thing is, yeah, today that is so true. Yeah. In the 50s and the 60s, like I think
absolutely.
I've got
Ben-Hur, somebody bought. Come on.
There's so many C movies. I don't even call them B movies.
They're movie, no, but there's endless movies about Samson. How many different times did they make Ben-Hur? The Ten Commandments, like giant biblical epics.
Charlton Heston playing Moses. It was unbelievable.
And you don't have to tell me that Ben-Hur is the story of a guy who meets Jesus. I know Ben-Hur is the story of a guy who meets Jesus, but it's still largely about Jews.
Yeah. Because, you know, eventually.
Yeah, but it's like, that... no, they Samson and Delilah stories. Like, they made these great big biblical epics. They just don't do that anymore. And they don't want to hear about that stuff anymore,
well,
is my point.
That was, remember the show, did you see the show Goliath?
Yeah, such a good show.
Oh my God, it was so good.
No, it's called King. You're thinking of Kings.
Well, Kings, yeah.
Yes, Kings is what it was called. It was the story of King David, and it was amazing.
And
America had no interest in the story of King David being told in the present day.
Yeah, because it was amazing. Goliaths were the tanks.
Yeah, were the tanks, exactly, because of the David and Goliath thing. Yeah, they had to modernize it.
Yeah, they modernized it a bit.
To
and
explain
what's
how he became a military hero.
From Deadwood.
Yeah, Deadwood's, oh God, this is an embarrassing one for us both to
terrible
forget.
L. Ooh. Starts with an L.
Does it though? But the point is, Al Swearengen from Deadwood was the king of,
was King
Gilead.
David.
No, yeah. No, the kid was King David.
Oh no,
he was the king of
Gilead. The kid, he was King Saul.
Yeah, King Saul. Thank you.
He
I always
was
forget
king
his
Saul. Name. And there were those the Goliaths. The kid was David.
David, and it was going to tell the whole story of David in set in a version of modern times, and it was. Yeah. It was a great 6 episodes,
oh,
and then it went away very fast.
You know, particularly when you had the soothsayer.
Oh, I know.
You know, when Saul keeps going to see the soothsayer, and of course he's not supposed to, and you have... It was really, really good.
I guess what we're really trying to say here is
there's
Old Testament... No. The Old Testament is the foundational text of a lot of our... Even beyond our laws and our culture, it's the foundational text of a huge amount just of our storytelling. And if you want to have, not only are there a huge amount of great stories based on the Old Testament, but if you want to have a better understanding of why we love those stories and why they've spoken to people for so long, it's not a bad idea to go and read the Old Testament.
Well, yeah, you can skip Numbers
you can skip all of the law books.
No,
just read
the
story parts.
No, some of the law stuff you should read, but Numbers is just basically genealogical. So if you genealogical
from
stuff,
so-and-so begat really? So-and-so from so-and-so begat so-and-so.
So-and-so, so-and-so lived so many years and had, and they, you know, and so it's just, you know, doing all of this for whatever reason, the final editors left all of that in. And hence we have 2 or 3 different genealogies for Jesus. If anybody wants to be interested, you have these different genealogies for Jesus because...
Which, by the way, I mean, we're gonna end this episode right now, right?
Yeah.
We're going to end this episode in a second, right? But I just want to say, for people who are like, well, it was always clear. It was always clear to everyone that Jesus is meant to, Mary was meant to be a virgin and divine birth and blah, 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 blah. And he's not technically Joseph's son. Yeah, he's not technically Joseph's son. That's why the first thing that happens in the New Testament is a genealogy about how he was the direct descendant of King David through his father.
Joseph.
Yeah, because that wasn't really his dad. That's why, like, dude, come on. Read the frigging Bible. It's very clear.
Read Matthew.
It could not be more clear. But anyway, that's enough. This has been Profiling Criminal Minds Bible Talk. Well, the thing is, the Bible comes up so much because, let's face it, Puritans invented serial killers, which we're going to get to in the next episode. But yeah, no, I mean, honestly, don't be surprised if at the end of the season we remember this episode fondly.
Yeah.
Let's move on to give us the plot of the next episode.
Okay, this one is called Scarecrow.
Yeah.
When Yakima, Washington authorities receive reports of a woman being abducted and later unearth two sets of female remains in a creek bed, the BAU determines they are searching for a serial killer driven by a twisted sense of morality.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Reed receives an upsetting phone call and the team welcomes profiler Stephen Walker into the fold.
Yeah, so this is this weird situation where Reed is going to be gone.
Yeah.
For a number of episodes. And then he's going to have the prison storyline. And they bring in Steven to shore up the team, which I don't dislike the character, Steven. It's just like, you didn't need another character. You've got too many characters already.
Yeah, why do you need... Yeah.
Why do you think you need another character? Because here's the thing. I just... Spoiler alert. Steven is never going to distinguish himself. In the, like, he's perfectly fine, he's there, he's, you know, like, he's, the actor is just as good as at reading the lines as everybody else is, but he doesn't, like, the character doesn't change the team's dynamic in any way, shape, or form. And you can say, well, neither did Luke, and the answer is no, of course Luke didn't, but that's because he's just there to recreate the dynamic that Derek had, and he's just a less toxic version of Derek. Whereas... Steven isn't replacing Reed.
No, right? He isn't replacing anybody.
Anybody. So why are they adding another character? And I, to this day, I don't know why they're adding.
No.
Why and they then, added Steven.
Yeah, I don't know why. And not only that, they fire him at the end of the season.
I know.
Everybody will be happy to know that he immediately had other jobs.
Good.
Lined up.
But yeah, like he, and he gets written out right at the end of this. It's very
strange. And then
strange.
They decide to replace him.
Yeah, well, we'll have that conversation as we go forward. When we get to the end of the season. When we get to the start of the next season and talk about Daniel Henney and him being transferred over and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's very interesting. All right, but let's get into this episode, which, as they mention within the episode, is very loosely based on... the start of the episode is based on a real thing that happened, which is that they don't know whether to associate it with the Long Island serial killer or what. But so there was this woman who was a sex worker, and she was out on Long Island at a party, and whatever, as they understand it, something went awry. And the question is, was she lured out there by a serial killer? Did just something go bad at a party she was at? Nobody really knows, because she ran off and... people don't know what, and she banged on doors and nobody let her in, and her body was found in a field, right? So that is what the opening of this episode is based on, and they actually reference that within the episode, right? They mention that specific crime that really happened. And what's interesting about this story is, like, there are people who will tell you, well, no, what happened was she was partially high on a drug and she just got lost, like, caught in a swamp. And died of hypothermia because it was like, you know, 40 degrees out overnight and you get waist deep in a swamp and it sucks out your body temperature quick. So if you're already high and you're already kind of drunk and you start freezing, it can go very badly for you very quickly. I don't know what happened to this woman. The Long Island serial killer hasn't been caught, but I'm just giving you the full context of the true story behind this episode. Now, let's get to the actual episode, which... is the reason I brought up the Puritans invented serial killing. Because the show has gotten into it before, and we've talked about it somewhat, but it's fair to say that basically, if you learn about violence instead of learning about sex, you're going to turn into a serial killer. Now, that's a gross oversimplification, but it speaks to the truth of how serial killers are created. And this show, more and more, has dealt that. And so, and this show, this episode explicitly just says what I just said. This guy was fooling around with a girl who was age appropriate to him. His father found them, and his father brutally tortured him for having 100% normal sexual experimentation with an age-appropriate partner. And brutally tortured him for that, and I mean, we know the torture continued, obviously, and that turned him into a serial killer. And I know it's not that simple. It's not like serial killers happen, but if you go 99% of serial killers you hear the story of, the story is going to be, in their childhood, they were tortured and sexually humiliated for, you know, any number of reasons. And so they never had a chance to develop, you know, normal sexual feelings, relationships, thoughts, blah, 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 blah. And that is how they became serial killers. And this episode is all about that, and is all about giving us the smartest and best victim the show has ever had. This lady is my hero.
Oh, yeah.
I love her so much. Like, she just does everything right the entire episode.
Yep.
Like, right down, I mean, here's the only thing she doesn't do right. She doesn't stop stabbing him once she gets the start. Like, she does the thing that girls do in horror movies. She stabs the guy in the neck and then she runs away. And it's like, no, just keep stabbing him. He's going to stop moving eventually.
Yeah, but
and
we knew that BAU was on its way.
Oh, yeah, of course. And dear people watching this, if you're ever in this situation, keep stabbing the guy over and over and over again. Never stop stabbing him. He's going to stop moving eventually, the guy who's trying to kill you. And then after he has stopped moving, stab him for 3 more minutes. So
Just so you can be sure.
Pick a song that you know by heart that lasts about 3 minutes, you know? I like The Underdog. And just sing that song to yourself while you're stabbing. And when that 3 minutes is up, you know, then stop stabbing your rapist / serial killer. Is this the worst advice I've ever given?
Well, I don't know, because I'm not sure how many of our listeners will ever come in contact with a serial killer. But then again, if you've got a serial killer, this one was smart enough to figure it out, but then she had her own background that allowed her to figure this one out.
To know what these people are like. You know, yeah. I mean, it's the character is very good, and they establish how she... Oh, and one last tip, just an FYI. If you're a woman, after you've murdered your serial killer or rapist, whatever house you were in, burn it down and don't tell the cops that happened. And the reason is, the cops will, you, assuming your attacker was a man, they will always jail women for killing men. Just as a general rule. It's horrific, but America is, this is all assuming you live in America. America is just absolutely chocked full of stories of women killing their rapists or attempted serial killers and then being thrown in jail for having done it. They don't, there is a, going back to the ages when women were property, there is an assumption that women are not allowed to act in self-defense.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a true fact that so many women were being groped and sexually assaulted on public buses throughout the Northeast, Boston, New York, and everything, that women started wearing like 8-inch to a foot long hat pins in their hat. And when women men would start grabbing their asses and breasts on the street, they would pull out these needles and stab the men with them. And it was decided that the biggest threat to America at the moment were women defending themselves from gropers. So hat pins were made illegal.
We're not supposed to defend ourselves. No, we're not supposed 100%.
To. Yeah, women are not supposed to defend themselves. And you think, oh, that's an attitude that's gone back. You know, that's that's the past. That's not how it works. No, it's still that way. You can search today for women shooting men in self-defense in their own homes and going to jail for it, because all of society is arranged against the interests of women. I'm only talking about America here, but there's actually a lot of other countries that are the same.
Or worse.
Okay. So what I'm saying is, we love what a hero this woman is.
Yes.
But in real life, it could have gone very badly for her the way she fought back.
Yeah.
Like, I love this character. She's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. So way to go. I mean, you stayed alive through the whole episode. You did the right thing in every situation. You humanized yourself. You talked about your kid. You got the guy to talk about himself. So he would like start to see you as an equal because you've gone through the same kind of things he has. Like, so well done.
Yeah.
Like, the writing is good. The acting is good. Like, I'm so on board with this character all the way through the episode.
And what I would say, Karen, the sisterhood is happy.
Damn right. Oh, is that who wrote the episode?
Karen Mazur, yeah.
Oh, well, great job.
Yeah, great job, Karen.
It's so rare we get this much detail about one of the victims.
Yeah.
And the victim to be, you know, presented in such a great light that I was just, everything about her in this episode makes me super happy.
Yep.
You know, it really does. So, thumbs up to the whole team for this episode. Oh, and the killer gets to wear a creepy scarecrow mask. So
yeah.
That's good too.
You know, just to give the title
Right, the episode's called Scarecrow. I keep forgetting that. Well, no, I mean, it comes from the fact that that's how his dad tortured him. He hung him in a field.
Unbelievable.
Oh, I know.
They did such a... And if I thought that it wasn't so... You know, but you can read, I mean, people do not go and read case histories, and I'm sure a lot of these people don't, but there are some horrible stories, you know, that all you have to do is read case histories.
So you're saying that monstrous child abuse that he suffered at the hands of his father isn't unrealistic at all?
No, not at all. Not at all. It's, you know, I don't think it turns all of them into serial killers.
Of course not. No. And honestly, had he just smashed his dad head in and turned him into a scarecrow, we'd be fine with this guy.
Yeah.
We'd say more power to you, buddy. But he made the mistake of having been sexually warped by his father's abuse. So we saw the result.
And that sexual warping would have happened earlier on.
Oh, absolutely.
Would have begun. Even before that, right?
Oh, even before then, yeah.
It's simply because, as I've said, and people just get so mad at me when I say things like that, but Christianity has an obsession with sexuality in a way that most other religious systems don't.
There are so many more serial killers in Catholic and Puritan majority countries than in any other country.
Well, yeah, because it is. Now, I'm not saying that other countries are places that women want to go and live. I'm not saying
that
at all. Okay, please do not take that from me. But Christianity itself, as a religious system, began with this massive, after the first little initial group, right? The obsession with sexuality, and you don't find it in the New Testament. It's not a New Testament phenomena, but it is when it became wider, but you saw it very quickly. And like by the end of the first century, you're already seeing all of these writings, and partly it is because of the... I do have to write that book, don't I? The sexual...
You really do! I keep telling you this! Please, people, send her an email asking her how the book is going. I've been trying to get her for more than a decade now to write a book about how, let's face it, the entire setup of Christianity ensures that child abuse is going to keep happening and sexual assault of women it's all baked into the religion itself. There's a lot of great evidence for it. She's already done 80% of the work. She just has to write the book. So please, she doesn't listen to me, start emailing her at the profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com address and say, how's that book about Christianity going? Maybe that'll... She reads all the emails. Maybe that'll help get her off her ass and write this thing.
Well, no. You know what would help?
What?
Is if I had... If I really actually didn't have to work... And
then
make
you could
money
do that full time,
and have to do other things, because I am not in a university where any of the stuff that I do would be supported, or is even like, it is just too hard to explain. Like it's like I'm teaching that course on religion.
Yeah.
Right. And I made this. So I was explaining Buddhism and people don't quite understand what happens when you get off the wheel. It's not the same as Hinduism.
Yeah.
Right. Everything kind of dissipates. And so I'm trying to explain how, okay, I said, who's seen the Matrix? And so I'll say, you know, like the Matrix.
Okay? Remember in the Matrix how the architect explains that the Matrix and Zion are actually a repeating cycle of events over and over and over again. And the ultimate goal of Neo is to break out of this wheel of reincarnation. Well, that's all based on Buddhist thought.
And the dissipation of the self.
Yeah.
Right? The self is just all of these non-existent things, right?
Yes.
It's
fascinating.
Right? It is fascinating, you know. And of course, somebody complained to one of my fellow professors that I brought up the Matrix and compared it. apparently, he said, well, you know, Dr. Redmond is really brilliant and you should listen to her when she says things, you know, because she can make these connections that most of us wouldn't see. And then he was telling me all of this. And then he says, of course, Buddhism in the Matrix. Like anybody who knows a little bit about world religions can figure out, right?
It's interesting because this episode is rare in the show at putting the blame 100% at religious extremism. Yeah. It points it right at it. Like they say that the father was, you know, a fire and brimstone kind of guy. And they correctly acknowledge that the use of burlap. I mean, it's more about the scarecrow than it is about wearing sackcloth.
Yeah.
To be awful. Sackcloth is burlap. When you hear religious people talk about sackcloth, they mean burlap.
Yeah.
But anyway, wearing stuff made out of sackcloth. So you're constantly itching. The hair shirt situation, right?
Yeah.
Except it's way easier to get burlap than it is a hair shirt. But anyway, the episode lays it right at the feet of his father's religion. Not just his father's insanity and abuse, but the religion as being the cause of it. This, you know, natural human urges towards sexuality as being inherently sinful and needing to be controlled, and people's urges needing to be directed and saying you're a sinner for feeling things. Like all of that is the text of the episode. So, you know, so often we talk about the subtext and what's really going on here and what the characters didn't know and what the showrunners didn't know. But this episode, it's all right there in the text.
Oh yeah. And we didn't actually get we didn't get David Rossi telling us how.
Well, there are also good Kira. I know it's not religion. It's crazy.
It's not really the religion, you know. It's the
crazy person using it. Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah, we didn't get that. Thank you, Karen.
Misinterpreting it? No, it's not.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you, Karen, for not writing that freaking line in there
that we see over and over again in the other episodes. Oh yeah. Honestly, it's strong. And now I'll just say two things. One, and this is something I'm honestly asking a question for, if anyone can tell me, I would really like to know. Do the doors on silos really open inwards rather than outwards? Because it seems like that would be a bad way to build a silo, because then, like, if there was any leak or anything at all, or even just some grain went down from the top, there would be no way to ever get into the building, right? So this scene where David Rossi's trying to push open the door to help them get out, and they're pulling on the door because the grain is coming in and going to drown them all. But of course, it's coming down, so it's making it hard to push the door in. And I'm like, is that really how silos are built? Or is that just something for the episode? I'm honestly asking, if anybody knows, I would love to hear. Two, and this is the very dumb thing that got said this episode that I want to give a call out, because So they find the bodies wrapped in burlap, and we know that that is because of the Scarecrow connection. But they're trying to figure out the significance of the burlap, and because they don't know yet. And, Reed says the dumbest thing in the world, which is, maybe it's a forensic countermeasure. Because burlap disintegrates quickly, and once the wrapping, unlike with plastic, once the wrapping degrades, then the body will start degrading right away. And I'm like, yeah, but if you wanted the body to degrade quickly, why not just not wrap it? It can't be a forensic countermeasure, because if it were, he would just not have wrapped the body. It has to be meaningful. But then again, nothing's ever going to be as bad as the idea that keeping a bag full of body parts in your house is a forensic countermeasure. So this one I'll give him a bit of a pass for. All right. So yeah, that was Scarecrow. A surprisingly good episode. Entirely yes. On the strength yeah. of the, I mean, we didn't talk much about the team, what the team did, because we don't care. But like that one character, the writing around the character, the writing around the killer, like how they find the guy, again, has nothing to do with psychology. It's like they identify one of the victims, and is like, did anyone hang around her a lot? And they're like, yeah, these three guys, and only one of them is still alive and in the area. So
yeah,
you know, the end. It's actually they catch him using the logic of Silence of the Lambs. What do we covet? We covet the thing we see every day, right? If this is about arousal, well, obviously he's first going to be compelled to attack someone who first aroused him and he saw all the time. So they literally just, once they identify one of the the victims, it's not actually that hard to find him. Which, you know, I mean, again, that's pretty believable. That's how they did it in Silence of the Lambs. Like, who were the first lady's contacts? Oh, Jane yeah. Gum? Done. There you go. So, what's our final episode of the week?
Profiling 202.
Dear David Rossi, maybe just stop doing courses around your birthday?
When Rossi receives a chilling birthday message from prolific serial killer Tommy Yates, who is listed as one of the remaining escapees from the mass prison break, the BAU works with a team of up-and-coming FBI profilers to stop Yates from embarking on another spree. And as I would say, the sensible thing to your comment before I read this is when I got, the year after my mother died, I got a $325 ticket for going through a red light.
On the anniversary.
And yeah. When I finally got it, like I didn't think, and I got it, it was, a camera shot. And yep, it yep. was, you were in the car. And yep. I think Dive Mistress was in the car as well. Anyway, and I was just oblivious. And when I got it finally from Enterprise, and they're going, and I'm looking at it, and I'm looking at it, and I finally, and I can't remember it. And then I look at the date. From now on, ever yeah. since then, on August the 17th, I don't do anything. I don't yep. go anywhere. I just hang out because
that's yeah, you know you're going to. No, yeah, it is self-destructive. And yeah. it's the if there's one day of a year, you're going to be self-destructive. It's that day.
Because I'm too focused on everything else. Like, I would be, it wouldn't be deliberately self-destructive.
Nope.
It would
no, just, it's your subconscious.
Yeah.
Your subconscious is incredibly powerful. So you have to give yourself this little bit of help of saying, consciously, I know that I'm going to do this to myself. So I'm just going to avoid it. And David Rossi isn't capable of that level of self-reflection.
No.
Because this is, we find it loud. Like, dude, you are in charge of when these courses happen.
Yeah.
You don't have to schedule them on your birthday, the day of the year that you're most upset about the serial killer. But you keep doing it because you want to make your bad mood everybody else's problem.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
You know, like you want then, the attention.
And then he offers them a meal.
I know.
I think the best thing about that, this whole episode,
the cooking
best
scene?
Thing about, no, the best thing was when the one guy who's the brightest guy in the group looks
like,
at
I don't want to end up like you.
I'm not going
to.
No, I'm not. I don't know. No. But you're the best. I don't care.
I don't care.
I don't want to.
I am not ending up like David Rossi. I've got a wife. I've got kids. You know, no, I've got a kid. You know, I want a family. And I am not bringing home. I am not turning into a wreck the way you are, David Rossi. Mm-hmm. It's a really honest thing to have happen.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it doesn't, and I guess, why would it? It doesn't make David Rossi reflect on himself and his actions and his life as hard as it should.
No, he just, you know, yeah. I mean, he so thinks that everybody, well, that's, I mean, these are a bunch of people. I mean, it's the team itself. They're all mm-hmm. a bunch of people who are just so self-obsessed with themselves as so important yeah. that they can't have any other kind of life. Everything else in their life has to be subsumed to this particular
job. Yeah. And well, we'll always, I mean, we complain about it a lot, but that line where, you know, they give JJ this whole monologue about how, no, my pain is worse and more special than everyone else's.
Yeah.
And it's like, and but that's how they treat everything about themselves.
Yeah. You know, and they are narcissistic to the core. If there is one thing that you could call this entire team, yeah. it is narcissistic.
Oh, absolutely.
Every single one of them. Nothing
is unbelievably self-important.
Yes, and they have found one another. Birds of a feather flock together, and that's absolutely. Probably why Stephen Walker doesn't fit.
Because he's just too emotionally healthy.
Yeah, he's too emotionally healthy for the show.
Oh, I like that.
So he that's wasn't so going to work.
Yeah, so he could never work out. Oh, that's beautiful. No, I mean, it's frustrating, right? Like, it really is. Like, it's very frustrating because you watch them and you're like, no, like, it's good that he's leaving because they're sad that this guy who's so promising isn't going to follow them down this primrose path. And I'm like, but you're so unhappy,
yeah,
David.
Every one of you is so freaking unhappy. And miserable and doesn't have a social life.
Yep.
Nothing. Look at what happened to Reed, right?
Yeah.
And just last episode, right? Mm-hmm. And then you get, and we know Rossi is. Not one of them is a happy human being. Not even Garcia.
Nope.
You know?
No, she puts on a great act. She's not happy.
No.
No, it's fascinating.
Maybe Luke is the only one that comes close.
Actually, yeah, Luke does seem pretty, like, a pretty chill dude, actually.
Yeah, and he probably just keeps it, you know.
Well, no, I mean, I think he had to learn to compartmentalize when he was in the Special Forces.
Yeah.
So I think Luke is, you're right. Luke of the whole team is the closest to healthy of all of them.
Yeah.
Although we'll talk about the Luke episode when the Luke episode
Well, yes, but year. Then, yes, you know. Then
That's
there
a whole
are,
other conversation. Yes.
We'll get there. But at this point, at this point, we haven't done any of the other episodes coming up.
No,
but
exactly,
at this
absolutely.
Point, Luke is the sanest of the bunch.
100%. All right. So let's get to the actual episode we're here to talk about. The Womb Raider is back. Jesus Christ. I was hoping we would never have to say that name again. Thanks, show. And he's killing again. And you get this great moment where in the episode, they're like, why is he suddenly, you know, started killing again when he should be hiding out? Like, does he want to go to jail? And, oh, on the phone, you found out, what do you call it? On the phone, you found out that he said, no one knows how much time we have. And I bet that's significant. I bet that's meaningful. It turns out he has cancer. Oh my God, what a shocker. And I'm like, why are you shocked by this? Shouldn't you know that?
Don't you? Keep track of what
Don't
happens
you keep
to these serial
on this frigging guy. Yeah. Like the biggest, the most significant anniversary in your life is your daily check-in with this guy, and he's recently escaped, and you're supposed to be hunting him.
You'd wouldn't
think
know
that all of you would have every bit of his frigging file memorized if you're supposed to be hunting this guy actively. How did they not know he had cancer?
Yeah, because it's in the hospital records.
It's in his prison records.
Yeah.
How did they not know?
Well, Virgil Williams overlooked that when he wrote the episode.
It's a pretty big thing to overlook.
Yeah, like, I don't know how they didn't know that.
Yeah.
But
also a thing to overlook. We actually see where he, the second woman he kills, we see the map as they try to triangulate it.
Yeah.
And you look at it and it's like, there's a whole bunch of roads around there, right? Like there's not a whole bunch of roads around there. Like it's going to take him like half an hour to kill this woman and bury the body. You could have set up roadblocks. No, you don't know exactly where he is, but you know what cell tower he's closest to. There's only three roads leading to that place. Set up some roadblocks and catch this frigging guy.
Oh, yeah, but then they would have to call in the local PD, and you know what they think about working. Yeah.
That's true. Hey, how did he get David Rossi's phone number?
I don't know. He's in the book.
How did he find out where David Rossi... It's his cell phone. There's no book for cell phones.
Hey, what can I say? Yeah, old school.
Right. Old school. No, but it's like, how did he find out where David Rossi lives? Like,
it's in the book. What do I know?
Like, the man is both an FBI agent and a millionaire. There should be no way to find out where this man lives. I know. Now I'm just nitpicking.
Well, no, I mean, it's true. It's not like Tommy Yates is a Peter Lewis, who's a brilliant computer hacker.
No, he's just some guy.
He's just some guy whose life was screwed up and killed all of these
and abused by his children. He killed all of these women horribly to get back at his grandmother and the memory of his mother, who did not survive to protect him from his monstrous grandmother. Yeah. You know, like, so all of that, it's all very clear.
Right? Yeah.
Like, and the one thing we can say about this guy is he's not the kind of person who can, you know, either hack his way into government records, or B, so good with people on the phone that he can trick that information out of someone like Hannibal Lecter does in Red Dragon.
Yeah.
You know, when Hannibal Lecter does it, it's because he's so good with people, you believe that he could do it.
Yes.
When this guy does it, you're like, when this guy just suddenly has his address, I'm like, no. Nope.
No.
I don't believe it.
As I said, unless he's in the book.
Unless he's in the book.
But anyway, but this guy has to be hiding. I mean, again, these serial killers, their names have to be plastered over everything, you would think.
Absolutely.
After they escaped.
Absolutely. And that's actually something the episode brings up that is such a weird frigging mystery, because you're like, why would he want to get in a relationship? Maybe he wanted to pretend to be normal and blah, 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 blah. But more importantly, how could he go out in public without people recognizing that it's a famous serial killer?
Yeah, it's
the
not
show
like,
does not understand how hard it is to be a fugitive.
This is 2017.
Yep.
It's all over social media. It's all over your Instagram. It's all over because people
Facebook.
Are
like
and,
the thing
enormously,
is Reddit.
Enormously attracted to studying serial killers. Everybody loves to read serial killers.
I want you to, like, anyone who doesn't believe us, go to Reddit and just type in the search term true crime, and you will find a million people who are actively trying to use Reddit to solve crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they screwed up the lives of a bunch of people by saying they were the Boston Bombers.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, this is just a real thing that happens all the time on the internet. Like, they try to combine their forces to fix this stuff. And, like, and it's great. You know, I love that they try to do it. They helped catch the guy who chopped up his boyfriend and sent him in pieces. To Liberal Party headquarters in Ottawa and newspapers and stuff. Like, the internet actually helped catch that guy. And not, they weren't most of it, but they did help.
Yeah.
Right? And what it comes down to is, it's like, the internet loves this. So, of course, if there were escaped serial killers out there, the entire internet would be trying to catch them.
Yeah.
Because that would just be a fun project for everyone to involve themselves in. I mean, for the love of God.
Not me.
Have you seen this? Well, no, obviously. Not sane people, not emotionally healthy people. I'm sorry, that was mean.
That's
but
me.
Did you see this show Tiger King?
No.
Okay. Well, you do. I mean, I'm not going to get into the story of Tiger King, but it's like there's a rumor in it that this lady might have killed her first husband, right? Because her first husband mysteriously disappeared, right? And so she might have killed him, blah, 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 blah. That's one of the plot threads in this reality show. And it's like, it's just a reality TV show, and yet hordes of people are like, I would like to find out more and see if we can solve this case. Because people love seeing evidence of an unsolved mystery and thinking they can that it could be solved and wondering, can I look into this? What do you think the Kennedy assassination obsessiveness is about?
Yeah.
This could be solved. That's what people think. And so the idea that there are a bunch of serial killers out there who we know their faces, we know their names, we know what they looks like, they look like, people would love to do that. That's what Unsolved Mysteries was about. That's what, I mean, I hate to say it, but in the world of Criminal Minds, I feel like the Fox Network would have rushed out a weekly, they would have brought back America's Most Wanted just to deal with these 13 serial killers. That's totally what would have happened in the real world.
The History Channel or HLN.
Would have done bios of all of them. And it's like, here's the full bio. Here's the guy. And it's like, here's the number to call if you have information about how to find whatever this. I can keep forgetting Womb Raider's real name, which is why I have to keep
Tommy Yates.
Tommy Yates. Like, if you think you've seen Tommy Yates, this is the number to call at the FBI. Like, this show does not understand what the real world would be like, how the real world would respond to this at all.
Would have reacted to something like this, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so I...
Literally. Yeah. I know, yeah. And I will say, the way they solved this week's episode is, quite logically, I will say that psychology really factors in for the first time, almost all season, because they say, well, this entire thing has been about taunting David.
Yeah.
So what would be the worst way to taunt David? And that is to bury one of the bodies somewhere David is all the time.
Yeah.
And so the location, they got like the three parks he goes to and his house.
Yeah. And then David
is his house. Yeah. And it was at his house. But it's like, that's a completely logical thing to do. And at least they reasonably use psychology.
But, because David Rossi owns like 40 acres or 60 acres.
Somehow he owns a huge amount of acres.
Well, he's got millions of dollars. So.
He does, but that in season 15, when we see the front of his house, like when we see the neighborhood he's in for the first time, suddenly it's just the regular suburbs.
Yeah, you're going, like, how does he have 60 acres? Maybe he sold them all for building.
That's true. Maybe between this episode and season 15.
He
became a property developer and turned his spread into a new suburb, Rossi Estates.
So nobody could
sneak up on him again. And yet his wife gets kidnapped by a serial killer again. So obviously the Rossi Estates plan didn't work out. Oh my god. You can't say we don't have fun.
I mean, this is why we do it. We have fun.
It's true. That is why we're doing this. Oh my god. But anyway, yeah. But it's an interesting episode because a ton of it just focuses you in on... And I think the things that I find interesting in this episode are the windows it gives you accidentally into what kind of a man David Rossi is. Yeah. You know? Like, it really does. And I kind of enjoy the dinner scene between... The fantasy dinner scene between him and a murderer. That's an interesting concept. They've never given the impression that this kind of thing has happened before, and it will never be mentioned again. But for one episode, it's... It's weird because it almost feels like someone wanted to pitch a TV show where the gimmick was that's what the detective does. He constantly has fantasy conversations with the killer he's chasing.
Yeah.
And each week there would be a new killer and there would be a new character who was just constantly hanging out with the detective. And I would watch that show. Just FYI, who wrote this episode?
Virgil Williams.
Virgil, if you want to actually do that show that you seem to be pitching here, I will watch your show. I promise. But it's just, it doesn't seem David Rossi-y. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, I like the scene. It just doesn't seem authentic to David Rossi, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Okay, good. I was worried I was going too far.
No, but, you know, it, Yeah, that was an interesting scene. That's the funny thing is like these few episodes have been, while they're not big on profiling.
No.
Okay.
There's a lot of interesting stuff in this week's episodes.
Yeah, these three episodes are actually from beginning to end. So maybe the fact that Erica's not around all that much means that freed them up to write, you know, more
experimental, interesting things. Yeah.
That they don't have to put in, you know, the three killed, and they don't have
the
to
three
put
killed.
And we have.
Oh my god! I just realized it. You're right. In none of these episodes, only in this episode do you get the two people, and then the third one gets rescued.
Yeah.
Of the three episodes. But even that, this episode is so not about the serial killering doing his all. It's entirely about his relationship with David Rossi.
And
even though it has the serial killing, that's not a big part of this episode.
Yeah, and the profiles.
Yeah.
Right? You know, the standing up in front of a bunch of cops with their profiles isn't really happening either.
No, because like two of the episodes, one, he's just hanging out with his students. And the other one, they're chasing down Peter Lewis.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they don't, the show, when they give up what is supposed to be, what they think is what everybody's coming to the show for, that's when things really get interesting.
Yeah. They can do some interesting things, these writers, which is why these writers have shown up on other shows afterwards.
Well, yeah, they get other jobs afterwards. But again, Virgil. Yeah. Do the show about the detective who's constantly talking to the imaginary version of the killer he's chasing. Like, yeah. I think that would be a great thing for you to do, Virgil. I want you to do that show.
Yeah. Pitch
that. We are there every episode.
Yeah. Now, we might do a podcast about it and rip it apart.
Right. Oh, no. Hey. Oh, of course we will. No. But I mean, I hope Virgil would expect that from us at this point.
At this point, yes.
Now I am imagining a relationship between us and Virgil. No, he doesn't know who we are, and that's the way we should keep it.
Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, like, you're
right. I don't
think
anybody
It's possible that in the second season, when she was off trying to save and ensure that they're keep... Because I gotta say, you know that she spent the second season of, Beyond Borders trying to quote-unquote save the show. Because there is no, like, if you're Ray Donovan... You go in every year, you know you're only going to do 13 episodes a year.
Yeah.
You just know that what you're in for. But when you start out as a mid-season replacement, what you want is to come back next year doing 22 episodes.
Yeah.
You don't want to stay a mid-season replacement. You want to be a real show the next year.
Yeah.
And the fact that it only got to come back as a mid-season replacement is not a sign that CBS had any confidence in the show Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. So it really creates the situation where you know that her only goal in season two was quote-unquote rejiggering and saving Beyond Borders so that season three was a real season. So I would imagine that however little time she spent working on season 11 of Criminal Minds, she must have spent much less working on season 12. Because season 11, you know, Criminal Beyond Borders, you just hope it does well. Season 12, you need it to do well.
Yeah. And sadly, it never breaks the top.
Why are you saying sadly? We're happy that
show
got canceled.
We're happy it didn't. No. it didn't even, I mean, as I said.
It never made the top 10, yeah.
Oh, it never made the top 20. It never made the top 30.
Oh, my God.
Oh, I one of the numbers was... Can't remember. I think it sort of opened up at 46.
I have rarely been as heartened about the state of America as when you tell me that America was as disgusted by Criminal Minds Beyond Borders as we are. We talk a lot of crap about America on this show. And if you are American, as most of our listeners are, we are sorry that we paint your country with such a broad brush from time to time. I think all of our complaints are valid and based on real things, but it can seem like we're just generally anti-American sometime. And I apologize for that. And I will say, I am proud of you as an entire nation for disliking Beyond Borders as much as we do.
Yep.
You were on the right side of history, America, when you refuse to give Ed the time of day to Criminal Minds Beyond Borders.
Yeah.
All right. So yeah, I guess we'll wrap up there. What is the homework if they want to keep up with us for next week?
Seek and Destroy.
Oh, what is Seek and Destroy?
Series of home invasions in upscale San Diego turn deadly. Gang of thrill seeking adults. It sounds so generic.
Oh, yeah. The Manson family one. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Surface Tension.
No. Okay. What's that one?
When Tampa, Florida authorities discover a mysterious symbol on the bodies of two residents who previously...
Earthquake crazy guy. Yeah. Earthquake guy.
Yeah. What's really weird about season 12 is that I don't remember much of it. Like, it's,
It goes one in and out the other. Yeah,
I remember I did see this, but, you know, I'm going, oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
When does that mean the third episode is remote control car episode or no?
No, that's later. No, all that's right. Later.
All right, what's next?
This is called A Good Husband.
Which one is that?
See what I'm telling you?
Oh my God, titles, they're not helping me at all.
When two dismembered male torsos are discovered in Palm Springs, California, the BAU...
Yes, okay, gay serial killer. Yes, okay, yeah, all right.
And establishing a connection. Gotcha. Meanwhile, we've got a meanwhile.
Oh, I love meanwhile. But you don't have to tell us the meanwhile now. That can wait until we're actually...
Till
we're actually watching the episode.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah, I remember that one now. Okay. So yeah, there's a lot to discuss next week. This should be fun. All right. So I'm going to encourage you to join us back here next week for that. On Tuesday, we'll be doing, I believe, the last episode of our run through Criminal Minds Beyond Borders Season 1, a show we despise. Is that the best word for it?
That's the nicest thing.
Best way to characterize our feelings for that show?
Yeah.
Despisement?
Yes.
So. Join us back here for that on Tuesday, and then you'll never have to hear us complain about the show again. So that's good. And then, of course, join us back here next Thursday for those episodes. If you were listening to this podcast through some sort of downloading service, app, if you go to iTunes, please review it, because that's how people find the show. We'll see you back here next week for more Criminal Minds. But until then, I'm going to say au revoir.
And have a good weekend.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.